Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello and welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John. And this week we're talking about history, ancient and modern.
What is the purpose of people congregating that's a fairly densely packed settlement? You don't build your city if you don't have a source of potable water.
We're going to give up the bulk of this episode to a single interviewee, actually, a guy called Rob Monaco, who is, in fact, he's a social studies teacher in Connecticut, in suburban New York. But the reason we've got him on here is because he's better known as the guy behind the podcast History of Our World. So he's going to come on and tell us all about where cities come from. It's like where babies come from, with more, you know, metro maps and so on. But that's kind of a difficult subject to talk around. So we thought what we'd do at the beginning is to kind of talk about, you know, Stephanie, you're not from London. What are you doing here?
I'm not from London. So I came here to study a master's degree at Queen Mary University of London because it was the place that gave me funding. And I've tried to move away unsuccessfully, and after about 6 months in the provinces got sucked back in. So the city's kind of got its claws into me. You are from London?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm from suburbia. So I'm from one of those places that hardly anyone there would consider it London, but anyone from outside the southeast of England obviously would. So we have the Tube and we have the Metropolitan Police and, you know, casual racism and so on. It's the kind of very un-London bit of London, but it is technically London.
How long have you been in London proper? I can tell someone's going to write in about that.
14 years. I moved into the centre of town straight after university, and it was awesome because we got this sort of nice Victorian house in a rather unfashionable bit of town, and then the rent was like 300 quid a month, and we had great landlords, and it was basically like living the dream. And, you know, it's exactly the same as it is today, I'm sure. So how's the house hunting going?
It's fine. I mean, I want to tear all of my nails off and scream at the sky. Sorry, for listeners at home, you won't be able to know the kind of face I just did when John said the words £300 a month for an ex-Victorian.
I'm not saying I was deliberately trolling you there, but I obviously was.
Yeah, I mean, I am going to beat you up once you leave this room. Yeah, the house hunting is going okay. I'm having to accept that because I live in Whitechapel right now, which is very central and lovely, and I can walk to work. That is no longer going to be the case on my next move, which is a shame.
Do you feel it's some kind of moral failing that you can't stay in Whitechapel? Like, do you feel like you've done something terribly wrong, that you're being pushed out?
I mean, doing a humanities degree and going into the arts rather than financial services. My father would call it a moral failing. But you've got much more of a history in London to me. So I only moved to London a few years ago. So what's your kind of sense of how the housing market has changed?
For all the stuff I write about it, I don't actually have first-hand experience of it because it gets worse. Not only did I move to London when rents were still... I mean, that felt crazy at the time. I was paying nearly 100 quid a week in rent, and that was before I had a job. And that seemed like an absolutely ludicrous amount of money to commit myself to. And it's like, what the hell am I doing? But you know, in retrospect, obviously, those were the golden times. But not only that, I've been living in a flat I own for the last 6.5 years.
It's just the dark secret of City Metric.
It's not a dark secret at all. It's like I've written stuff about how like I own a flat and it's brilliant, and but I still want the prices to fall. For largely selfish reasons, in that at some point we'd like to own a bigger home, and that's not happening. So it's like, despite the fact that, you know, in theory and through no virtue of my own, I'm sat on this enormous pile of capital now, I'd still rather have slightly less of that and more of a future.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm just going to locate my tiny violin for you right now.
It is horrible. I mean, sometimes like the boiler goes, or like, you know, or some noisy renters make a noise, and like, you kind of just... I mean, they're the scum of the earth, really, is what I'm saying.
I'm going to murder you. I am flat hunting at the moment, which is... So I've done this in a couple of places. I lived on my own in Exeter for about 6 months. And to be fair, I'm not finding it substantially worse to do it in London than I did in the southwest. But I don't know if that's just because it's such a boring, miserable experience anyway, that there's only so much worse it can get, having to call estate agents every day and kind of...
Okay, kind of spell it out for us. What is horrible about it? Like, surely you're looking for a new home. That's exciting, isn't it? That's like, you're finding your future.
Well, I think the most miserable thing about flat hunting, which you won't know about because it will have receded into the mists of time for you, is the website rightmove.co.uk, which I have a deep burning hatred of, because it's one of these house finding websites where all of the information and pictures are there, but you don't have to put the date the flat is available on the website. Ooh. And you cannot filter by that. So I kind of spend like half an hour every day just clicking on pictures of sad one beds in Walthamstow and weeping.
So is the problem that they've been there for ages and are therefore horrible, because if they're any good they would have gone, or there's already a queue of people? What's the...
All of the above. So often they've already gone. Now in London it's got to the stage where if there's a nice flat, rather than saying call the estate agent, it will just say open viewing on, you know, September the 8th or whatever, and they just open the flat up because there's so many people who want to look.
And it's like an auction, basically.
It is, basically. A lot of them say, you know, offers in excess of $1,200 a month. So you go, there's not even a set price for that flat. You are going to have to bid to rent a flat, which to me seems to be a relatively recent thing. I don't remember when I moved to London, it was quite so tight, but that may have been what I was looking for then compared to what I'm looking for now.
Okay, so these websites are horrible. Why don't you just do it the old-fashioned way and go to a lovely estate agent and get, like, the personal touch? That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Again, you can't tell, but John is smiling in the most self-satisfied and awful way. Well, because I don't know exactly where I'm looking, and also because London is so overpopulated with estate agents that even if I knew exactly where I was looking, there would be 4 or 5 within a square mile, and I would have to go into all of them and register my details 5 or 6 times. And also, I accidentally gave my details to Foxtons, and now my phone rings all the time. And
What about letting fees? We haven't covered them. They're fun.
No, okay. we haven't covered them.
I mean, you're paying for quality there, right? Like, it's the fact there's such a high letting fee is how you know that you've got a really good estate agent.
Are there any other miserable things you want to talk about?
I'm on a secret mission to just reduce you to hysterics.
It's working. Yeah. Letting fees, yeah, they're high in the city. Yeah, I've seen everywhere from kind of £400 all in, which I thought was outrageous until I found places that were, you know, £150 per person plus inventory plus referencing. Well, but it's based on kind of whether or not they need to attract landlords, because I think particularly when I lived in the southwest, there was still a relatively high letting fee for... I was a PhD student living on my own, so it still felt relatively high, but I know the landlord shouldered a lot more of the costs, whereas I think in London there's such competition just to get property on the estate agent's books, they kind of say to the landlord, hey, we'll make it the tenant's problem if you register with us.
It's supply and demand, isn't it? There's just a huge number of tenants looking for not a huge number of flats, and that pushes up prices and puts all the power in the hands of the landlord and the agents.
What could we do about this, John?
I don't know. If only there was someone with some kind of a slogan that you could print on a T-shirt. You can buy Build More Bloody Houses T-shirts, by the way. I do actually own one. Okay, I was out in it the other day and a couple of people gave me the thumbs up. It was nice. It was like being a really rubbish superhero. Really rubbish. Also, I was at, this is getting just really weird now, but I was at a party, our colleague Julia's party, in fact, on Friday night. And Owen Jones was there, slightly the worse for wear, and yelled, "All right, man, built any houses recently?" So, yeah, that's my...
You're getting house heckled by Guardian journalists
I am
now.
Getting house heckled.
That's amazing. That's fantastic.
So, but no, I have not, in fact, built any houses recently, because I have no practical skills. I write bad columns on the internet, is what I do. Okay, so I feel like we're drifting away from our original subject.
We are drifting
subject.
Away from our original, yeah, so...
Living in London, moving to London now, if you're not massively rich, is horrible. Let's not...
No,
let's
it,
not
is,
lie
it,
to
is, it is
it's
a genuine nightmare.
Awful experience, and yet people continue to do that. Why is the supply and demand thing not corrected itself and everyone just not thought, oh, sod this, I'm going to Manchester or whatever?
Well... Because loads of the jobs are here and loads of your friends are here and you can go to other places easily from here. And because every other part of the economy is tilted in London's favour, the fact that you can get a gorgeous two-bedroom in Deansgate for about as much as I'm paying for a room, not to dwell on that.
Deansgate's like right in the middle of Manchester, right?
It's fairly central and they're beautiful old converted warehouses right next to Media City. Yeah.
But, I mean, okay, the Britain is an extreme case here because we are so ludicrously over-centralised, as we've talked about quite a lot. This problem is not unique to Britain, because if you look at the US, which is a much less over-centralised economy, you still have the same kind of thing in New York where people are paying through the nose for, you know, literally cupboards.
Yeah, and you have it in San Francisco where the tech industries are centralised. Basically, if you have cities where an industry is so focused on it that almost anyone who wants to work in that industry is going to have in the back of their mind, oh, I should really be in that place.
Yeah. I think it actually goes a bit beyond that. I think with the value being generated in the world economy is increasingly focused on a few places, like, you know, there is kind of this worldwide phenomenon of, like, all the jobs are sort of pouring into the big cities and away from smaller towns. And with the financial crash and the lack of other assets to invest in, so much capital is just poured into the value of land and property in those places. Because if you own a square foot of London or San Francisco or whatever, that's probably going to hold you in good stead during a financial crisis. So just property values in every major world city has gone haywire.
And it really indicates how what might have been kind of the dream of the digital age, which is that you can work from anywhere and everything's kind of networked, hasn't come to fruition when it comes to land prices at all, because you can work from anywhere but people still want you in the office.
Yeah, but I think it's a two-way thing. Like, it's you also still want to be near colleagues and friends and other companies you can go and work for. I don't think it's just that companies are... It's all about presenteeism. I think it is actually people do want to be near to other people in their industry. And I don't think you can work around that just by saying, hey, do it on Skype. We've just did a very long way away from, like, this was meant to be sort of a modern history lesson, which we failed miserably to do, but that's fine. This is fine.
But I think we're ending at a point where we can move on to the most important thing, which is, do you want to get a drink after work?
Yeah, we can do that. I assume I'm buying.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that's quite enough of us. Now for the main attraction.
This is a Brooklyn-bound A express train. The next stop is Dyckman Street. This is a 125th Street-bound A express train. The next stop is 59th Street, Columbus Circle.
My name is Rob Monaco. I started my little history podcast project back in 2012. The podcast history of our world. I really wanted to kind of create my own kind of a comprehensive world history. I heard, you know, some people doing little bits here and there that I liked, but it was not something that I could dive into. I wanted something that was more story, but could give me the details that I needed. And maybe there's, you know, a few terrible jokes here and there. And 71 episodes later, just covered the downfall of the Roman kingdom. The Roman kingdom, yeah.
Not the empire, not even the republic. You've made
not even the republic.
The downfall of the Roman kingdom in, I believe, the 6th century BC.
Yeah, 6th century. Yeah, so episode 72, which is going to come out soon, kind of starts off at the traditional founding date of the Republic, 509 BC. It's not really a republic at this point, more of a transitional pseudo-dictatorship, but with voting. But it's good. There's a lot of really wonderful primary source information out there that it's hard to find some of the earlier stuff.
I mean, before we get into the sort of the origin of the world cities, I've got to ask, like, are you slightly concerned about, you know, literally dying before you get to the 21st century?
I mean, hopefully, you know, maybe I can pass the torch on to someone at that point, and maybe they can take over. You know, I said that I wasn't going to dwell too much on some of these topics, and I'd like to pick up the pace a bit. But then there's such interesting little tidbits here and there, and one legend leads to this, and somebody's making up their own dialogue, and it's too funny, and I'm like, oh, I got to include this, and well, I am concerned, yeah.
Okay, so for the purposes of our conversation, we're gonna stick with ancient history, because you know that's the bit you've done. Let's go right back to the beginning. Where do cities come from? Why do we have cities?
Cities, in the ancient sense, I mean it's funny. A city in 4000 BC would be like a small village today, or a, you know, if you're doing it based purely on population, that you could have 2,000 people living in a place, and that's considered, you know, by the historians, a city. I think what you're looking for is, what is the purpose of people congregating in something that's a fairly densely packed settlement? That are there walls? Is there a social hierarchy? Is there a building that is taller than the other buildings? And what's the purpose of that building? Is it a temple? Or is it a palace? Is it a warlord's residence? Are there walls? Are there defensive structures? Do the animals live within the walls, or do they live outside of it? I mean, a city could probably, though, be defined as something that George Carlin once said. It's just a place to keep all your stuff. And then you get more stuff, and you got to find more room to put all that stuff.
So where did the earliest cities emerge?
That's where there's, I guess, a bit of debate. There are some sites in sort of southeastern Ukraine near Crimea that, oh, you know, people aren't sure if they are considered a city or not. If you want to find something that we can all say really was early cities, Çatalhöyük in Turkey, probably the earliest city, but Jericho could also be considered one of the earliest. I mean, the walls there kind of date back to late 7th millennium, but the more people learn about Çatalhöyük back in the Neolithic era, this has all of the hallmarks of an actual city. I mean, religious centers, political hierarchies. The big thing, of course, that you have a population that the majority of them are not responsible for food production. So if you don't have to worry about growing your own food, you can do other things like art and architecture and developing writing and math and all of these wonderful things that you can do if you don't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from.
It feels to me like there is an extent to which the city is, I mean, almost literally synonymous with civilization. I mean, the words have the same root, right? You can't have a civilization without an urban society, because that is, civilization is people not working on farms the whole time, right?
Absolutely. I mean, civilization comes from civitas, or I'm sure that, I don't know about the Latin speakers, maybe it's civitas. You know, that B and W, it always sounds so strange. But civitas is definitely that whole basis of, probably there's the Western slant on things, that a civilization has to have a city. And so naturally, when we go to places that are far away from the beaten path, and well, this is not a civilization, of course, because where are your cities? But there is a larger civilization for some of these people. Maybe the Kurgans or any of those wandering kind of Central Asian peoples maybe they didn't have cities, but they certainly had civilization. But I mean, John, I guess what you're saying is you are right, though, that you can't have advanced, developed. You're never going to get past kind of that Neolithic agricultural basis unless you have a city, and you can do remarkable things with it. I mean, you can build a civilization in the middle of a resource-strapped region if you have a city.
So, I mean, when you're talking about civilizations without cities, something that came to mind was I've recently been reading a book called 1493 by Charles Mann about the Columbian Exchange, and that's got a load of stuff in there about how one of the problems Europeans had when they got to North America for the first time was because sort of organized farming and the way of life looked so different in the North American setting that they just thought, oh, these guys are just savages, and didn't realize it was actually quite a complex civilization. It was just one that looked nothing like what they were used to in Europe. And then all these guys died of, you know, smallpox. So,
you know, like take the Iroquois. That's pretty advanced culture. But if they had developed those densely packed cities that you would see in Europe and Asia, in North Africa, would they have developed more of a disease resistance? Of course, you could look at the Aztecs, and I mean, I know it's not really ancient history. Tenochtitlan is built sort of 1300s, 1400s, and their city was probably the finest in the world at that point, but it also didn't do anything to stop them from getting horribly, horribly sick. But absolutely, the North American, as opposed to the South American cities, really, you're looking at Cahokia in Illinois now, and that was definitely a city, even though it comes later than probably some of the cities we'll be talking about, but it's also completely abandoned, and nature kind of reclaims it. And of course, the mystery is, you know, why. But cities don't always mean that more will pop up and people will want to stay there, and certainly that's not a resource-strapped region either.
I feel like, having said we were going to stick to ancient history, we then jump forward like literally about 4,000 years here. So
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Let's jump back in time a little bit.
Yeah.
When I was asking where the first cities were, I was surprised that you went to Ukraine. I mean, that's not somewhere I was expecting. I was kind of expecting a traditional sort of litany of maybe it was Sumer or Mesopotamia, or maybe it was Egypt, or maybe it was the Indus Valley. I mean, Crimea, really?
It's funny. I think I recorded one episode, and I forget what it was, but it was... I recorded the episode, and it was fairly early on, one of the Neolithic episodes, and I was like, what I'm telling you right now is, like, this is true. And it was, like, a year later, and somebody put out, it was with the Neanderthals, that the jury said, no, there was no inbreeding between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. I was like, okay, that's it, folks. And then a year later, they were like, no, there's 100% true that there was inbreeding. I was like, nuts. I got to go back and re-record. It's remarkable that there's more stuff being found that's sort of challenging the, you know, this is what we know, that the first cities are in the Fertile Crescent. Well, it depends on your definition of a city. I mean, if you're looking at a large settlement that has, you know, possibly 10,000 people, I mean, that's pretty big, but there's maybe people are more pastoral. Is that still a city? I don't know. I think this evidence is still fairly new, but certainly I would definitely say that Çatalhöyük is going to be your first city, that like a clearly defined city. Jericho is up there. If you want to go to Sumer, the first city there, I mean, and it's still fairly, I mean, we're talking 5000s BC at this point. That's Eridu in Sumer, and that's absolutely their first city in the region.
I always kind of find it a bit mind-blowing to think that by the time Rome is emerging as a player, we've already sort of, half of recorded history has already happened. I mean, we have historical records that go back to like the late 4th millennium BC.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's just crazy to me that like we've already had like 3,000 years of history by the time Rome becomes a thing. So
it's insane. You know, Rome, I mean, they even knew that there was ancient history before them. When Rome was just a baby, the pyramids are ancient history by that point, and they know next to, even the Egyptians know, they kind of know who built them. They weren't really sure at that point what the purpose was. They just knew that they were there. It's remarkable. And then, of course, that's where you get other people that, well, what, maybe there was stuff before all of this, and they just happen to not leave any evidence whatsoever, but,
So if there were already stuff going on before you get to Sumer or the oldest bits of Egypt, then why are those the two that you tend to kind of hear as, like, this is where history starts? Is it continuity? Is it just that, like, we kind of have a relatively continuous line from those places?
There's too much to memorize. That might be a little flippant, but you're told a narrative, and this is the story. You were told it growing up. You learned it in school, and that was told with authority, and that's that. And then you're told, well, there was actually something before that. Maybe you get used to it, and you're like, okay, fine, I will accept that there was something before Sumer. But then somebody makes a remarkable discovery, and now you're told that, oh, it actually goes back another 1,000 years. I think that in our kind of social consciousness, it's a lot to digest. And especially for those who maybe have terrible experiences with history class, they'd rather not go back in there. And, oh, really, there's a word that I can't pronounce. It's got how many umlauts over how many vowels and consonants? And no, I'm done. We're just going to say Sumer, period. Or Egypt, and people don't even realize that Egypt's not first. It's remarkable how much misinformation is out there, but it also, I think a lot of it is harmless. It's just, it's a lot to take in.
Can you kind of give us a bit of a guided tour of what, I mean, I'm asking a lot here, don't get me wrong, but can you give us a sense of what these very, very ancient cities would have looked like? Like, what features would they have had that would be recognizable to us today as urban? I mean, they didn't have, like, subway networks, right?
No, I mean, some of the later cities would have sewers. I mean, Rome obviously is probably the more famous example because they took sewers very seriously, and their sewers were huge. I mean, you could walk through them. But you would find, especially towards the Indus River Valley in Pakistan and India, grid systems, which is fantastic. China was a huge fan of grid systems. Some Greek cities, Rome, it's a type of grid system. It's not the best, but they get better at it. So you would absolutely recognize that there are clearly defined roads for carts and horses, sidewalks. You would find in some of the more clean cities, bathrooms, toilets even. You would find buildings for takeout, because absolutely, you are not doing your own cooking. a lot of these buildings are flammable, and no one is going to have, unless you are well off, they're not really going to be keeping a fire going too much in these places. It's actually a lot easier to just go for takeout. You would find parks, especially in the warmer climes. People realize the value that preserving parks would bring. The Persian emperors especially love their parks, which where we get our word for paradise from. It keeps you cool in the summer. It's natural air conditioning. It's a good thing. It's not the image of sort of like that slop-ridden medieval town that perhaps you would see in a Monty Python movie. That's really, I mean, I know for me at least, that was my image of most ancient cities, just gross and filled with all sorts of horrible things. Although it probably didn't smell the greatest. I mean, even the cleanest cities, horses have their own natural byproduct all the time. It can't smell that good.
What about lighting? I mean, did they use like candles or like oil lamps, or do we know anything about this? Or is this just there isn't the kind of data in the records?
I don't think it's any coincidence that a lot of these ancient civilizations, Mesopotamia, Levant, I'll exclude China for a moment though, but I mean, they all tend to pop up nearer the equator. So you are getting a lot of natural light throughout the year. I know a lot of Greek and Roman villas would have exposed lighting, like rooftops in a sense. But a lot of the time, it could be very dark in some of these buildings without a lamp post system, which some places would use. At this point, you're really relying mostly on, you know, individuals to sort of keep things well lit. I think it was, I want to say in the Sumerians, that you would have torch lamps sort of to keep it going. But it depends on the region. I mean, you need wax for candles, and you're not really going to get that much. You could probably get it from plant sources, but, or maybe, I know the Egyptians used hippo fat, but it's kind of hard.
I'm showing my ignorance here. I don't even know, like, what's the sort of geographic distribution of wax? Where can you, is wax something you only have in temperate zones or something?
That's true. I mean, I know. I mean, you can get it from plants and fat animals and stuff, but bees, you'd have to go and search them out. I mean, it's kind of, that's almost like its own little topic right there. I'd love to actually find out more about that now that I think about it.
I look forward to the waxy special at some point.
That'll be nice.
How about water? I mean, like, we did, this is one of our very first podcasts, actually. We did something on the importance of water for cities and basically about the fact that in the Arabian Peninsula right now, they're building all these cities and deserts for the first time in history because we now have the technology to use oil to desalinate water in the desert. And there are questions over how sustainable that is. So I'm kind of wondering, like, in the ancient world, like, do we know where they got drinkable water from? Like, are they literally just sort of pulling it straight out the river or in wells, or how does it work?
You're actually kind of right on some of that stuff. It's, you don't build your city if you don't have a source of potable water. And I'm sure that there were many failed cities and cultures at first who didn't realize that you need to keep your clean water maybe upstream from the nasty water. and you gotta separate the two. If you look at the earliest civilizations, they're all built next to a river. Some kind of river or stream or something where you have flowing water. Not a trickle, but something that has more of a push to it. Now, of course, that could just flood your city, which happens a lot, actually. But you need that because it keeps the water clean as well. You'll let gravity do a lot of the work for you. Irrigation, I feel like it kind of comes up around the same time throughout the world. But of course, the Sumerians are very famous for it because the farther out you go, there's not a lot of groundwater, at least not that they can get to.
But
we should just say, in case any of the listeners aren't aware, that Sumer is what? Southern Iraq?
It's southern Iraq, Kuwait. We are looking at sort of the region of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. So when we talk about, you know, Babylon, Assyria, these are all in the same region. It's a region that is very old, and people are always fighting over it, and it's kind of sad. But and interestingly enough, of course, that with Sumer, you look at the maps nowadays, and of course, this confused people to no end when they first saw it. It's, well, how do you build a giant city like this in the middle of the desert? And the truth is, they didn't build it in the middle of the desert. It's just that as the centuries pass, these two rivers keep on pushing silt further and further downstream. And it's basically, the city didn't move. The earth just built up.
The desert moved, basically.
Yeah, the desert moved. But you do see pipes as early as the fourth millennium. And this is something that, again, took me by surprise when I was doing my research. That I expected them to say, the experts, the Minoans of Crete, they had excellent pipe systems, waterways. The Babylonians had pipes. But really, the earliest so far that we can see of pipes and drainage ditches and toilets are in the Orkney Islands, all the way north of in Scotland. That's about towards the end of like 3000, 3100, 3000 BC. I'm probably mispronouncing it. It's something Scarabrae. They're really more large settlements than cities. I mean, I guess if we want to do the ancient history definition, we can call it a city, but they had pipes and toilets. I mean, and apparently, I mean, they were running water to sort of carry all of the effluent away. Which, I mean, I was reading this, and it blew my mind that you have such a culture that's so infatuated with sanitation, and it's pretty far away from everything else. I mean, it's amazing. It's older than Stonehenge. It's older than the pyramids.
My understanding is, in sort of the earliest history we have, the city is generally the sort of political unit. Like, there isn't a nation state or even an empire at that point. People belong to a city, and that's kind of where your civic identity comes from. When does that start to change? When do people in Eridu start to become Sumerian? Do they become Sumerian, or is this kind of something that we've imposed on them in history?
That took me a bit too, because I was always told, you're right, it's Sumeria, but it's not. It's Sumer is the region. I mean, Sumerians, like you said, they might think of themselves as the Sumerian race, which nearly it's the black-headed people. But, right, you would identify as a resident of that city. It's like the Renaissance Italian cities. That they're city-states. It's, yes, Florence and Genoa, they would consider themselves Italian peoples. But no, you're a Florentine, you're a Genoan. You know, it's, and likewise with Sumer. You're from Eridu, you're from Ur, you're from Uruk. You have your own kings, you have your own traditions, even though you all worship the same similar gods, you eat the same food, the buildings look very, very similar. It's with the introduction of the first people who decide it's not enough to just conquer and take over and pillage and plunder, and you stay and you say, that city's mine, that city's mine, that city's mine, and you have the first empires. Maybe, I mean, somebody might argue otherwise, but maybe Sargon of the Akkadian Empire, which is, again, in that region, again, I mean, it's all in this region, he could maybe be considered the first emperor, and again, you would have to identify now as someone of the Akkadian Empire, even if you're not ethnically Akkadian. Of course, they boot him out, or the Akkadians out, and then it's back to this. But the idea catches on that while you might hail from your own city, you pay taxes to the empire. And don't forget where your true loyalty lies. So maybe it's just one guy saying, I have a lot of regular stuff, now I want city stuff. And you just collect it.
I mean, we've all had that impulse on occasion, you know, I'm just going to go out and conquer some stuff today.
They get an itch. I mean, You know, I mean, it's nowadays, I mean, we could go on the computer, you play a few games, you know, that was great fun. I enjoyed that one. Back then, just with real people.
Okay, we should probably be sort of wrapping up, so it's going to be my last question, I think. But you're over there in Connecticut. You're kind of in a you're basically in the suburbs of New York, right? You're
sort of out. Yeah, and I grew up in New York, so I'm used to the big cities.
Yeah, but like, what do you think? This modern cities like New York could, is there anything they could learn from these really ancient places? Is there anything like you'd like to see? I'm struggling to phrase this question. Just kind of bring it back to the present for us. Give us some lesson from the past.
I like where you're asking me.
Do we need some big walls to kind of keep out the Acadians or something? Or
something? Well, I mean, yeah, right. I mean, we do need big walls, John. I mean, we need huge walls.
Gonna build the biggest wall you've ever seen.
Yeah. It's gonna be the best. It is telling that, I mean, yeah, I forget, it was one of my professors who was, you know, always saying that you can tell a lot about a city based on what the tallest building is. You know, it's first it's the palace, and then it's the temple, and then now it's, you know, the skyscraper. So business is the best. I would be happier if cities took the lessons of, don't just sprawl for the sake of sprawling, which I feel like, and you probably know a lot more about this than I do, that doesn't probably seem to be the direction nowadays. It's probably more vertical than horizontal.
It depends where you are, I think. I think, like, in Europe, that's never really been the direction of travel, because, I mean, particularly in mainland Europe, because you kind of, it's not that long before you hit a border a lot of the time. But yeah, I think in a lot of the United States and in China today and in parts of the Middle East, they are still kind of, cities push out as much as they push up. So
that's true. I mean, as somebody who's only really used to, you know, New York, it's an island. There's nowhere else you can go. So, I mean, as I overwhelmed as I still get sometimes, I can't help but be, amazed by the how much Manhattan, I mean, people have just made the most out of the space there, and how they remembered, well, some people remembered at least, that you got to make room for the earth. I would love to see a city that is technologically advanced for its time, much like these cities that we talked about, you know, the Minoans and the Indus Valley, Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. These are super advanced for their times. I feel like our cities nowadays, because of their age, that they are not technologically advanced anymore. I know it's expensive, but it's somebody's got to make the call to start saying, we could do so much more and let the natural world sort of take in. For that, I've seen blueprints. I think there was an Italian architect who was showing something very, very kind of like Lord of the Rings elven, you know, where you merge the trees and the vines together. It cuts down on like cooling costs and heating costs by some astronomical number. I would love to see more incorporation of the natural world, just like the Egyptians did, just like the Babylonians and the Assyrians. Just more of sort of a blending. Less Roman, like, those are the slums. We'll just let them do their thing, and if they catch on fire, that's when we pay attention. More take care of the city and treat it sort of as like a living, breathing thing. But it almost has its own spirit to it. Which, I guess, if I could be really ADD for a second, having that spirit, you know? It's like the city has its own persona, which, you know, you look at the Roman coins, they always have like a goddess of the city.
Doors are closing. London Overground and National Rail services. This is a Victoria Line train to Brixton.
Well, we don't want to go back to kind of our navel-gazing of the first half, so we put a shout-out on Twitter to ask you guys about moving to and leaving cities and why you do one or the other.
Okay, before I start reading out tweets, I just want to say, like, it's far less successful when I do this than when you do this, and I can't work out if this is because you're better at it than me, or people like you more, either both of those things are plausible possibilities, or whether it's just people really like explaining things to women on the internet. It's probably a combination of all of them.
Right. I don't know, maybe we should do a test where we both tweet the same thing and we'll see if we get different responses.
Yeah, we'll do a chart. We love charts.
Tune in next week for charts.
Yeah. Anyway, so look, I like this one. Laurie Goodman said, I left Washington, D.C. because the rats are the size of dogs and everyone there shops in J. Crew. I sort of asked, is that a real thing? And she said, well, the rats are large and people do love J. Crew, but I left because my visa expired. Sorry. The reason I read out the second tweet is because, and this kind of fits into the explaining things to women on the internet theme, someone called Michael Keane popped up to say, there'll be Rattus Norvicus, a lot bigger than Rattus Rattus. Would say everything bigger in US, but UK has both. So a little lesson in urban wildlife for you there.
Somebody called Chris Terry says he moved, I presume, to London because I wanted a career in politics, and in the UK your options are severely limited if not in London, would leave for a house.
I suggested to him that he moved to Manchester to work for Andy Burnham, and he replied, no. So I suggest old Andy has a bit of work to do there.
Good taste on Chris Terry's part.
Okay, this is a good one. A guy called Jack Thompson explaining why he decided to leave the countryside. It was because he got stuck in traffic behind Lady Starkey walking a dog by holding its lead out of the window of her Merc and realised that if it happened one more time, he'd go mad. I asked if that was a real story as well, and he replied, yep, it wasn't even a big dog.
Maybe it was a big rat.
Maybe it was a big Merc.
Would you ever leave London?
I mean, I might have to because I can't get a bigger house. I mean, we'll move to suburbia. I'll probably have to leave proper London to move back to, like, Zone 5 or something at some point.
I'm really excited for episode 1 of Suburb Metric.
You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Elledge and Stephanie Boland and produced by Royfield Brown. You can contact all three of us on Twitter, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. Our theme music was Waves by CORTR. You also heard We Are One by Vixento. All music in the show was licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast, on iTunes, or in the podcatcher of your choice. You can also find two more shows by our excellent colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps, and geography you could ever possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. And since you've listened this far, leave us a nice review on iTunes, eh? Go on. We'll love you for it. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하 서울역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명동.
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.